Support for the Sundance Reel on KPCW comes from the film Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, premiering during the 2018 Sundance Film Festival, a documentary about Sandra Lee's journey through breast cancer, from diagnosis to recovery, and encouraging early detection for all women.
It's 9:06 here on KPCW, and we've got our own Carolyn Murphy reporting on the rally happening here in Park City and City Park this morning. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning, Monica. Hey, so we've had a couple accidents out here on 248 and 224. 248 is cleared, I'm told, and 224, my understanding is they're still working on that. So as far as crowds, it's pretty light right now. There are a handful of people gathered in front of the stage. There are a lot of security people, a lot of law enforcement. And my understanding is buses are running pretty smoothly from Richardson Flat into town. The buses that were set up by the organizers are getting through. And so we are just moving along.
All right. Any word on any talk that anything will be delayed because of the accidents coming into town?
You know, there hasn't been any discussion about delays at this point, but I'm going to be calling back in just a little before the hour. I think we're scheduled to talk around 10 till, and I'll know some more at that point. As far as delays right now, it does not appear. I mean, I came in from Park Meadows on the bus. It was very clear going. It was, you know, not even really super, super crowded. I mean, the bus got through really well. It was almost on time. And so I think everything's running on schedule.
All right. Thank you so much. That was Carolyn Murphy calling in. If you're on your way to the rally, she'll be updating us later this hour. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you, Monica. Bye now.
All right. Bye. All right. Stay warm when you're going out there. It is still snowing, and the temperature here in town is right around 22 degrees. And we've got more of the Sundance weekend coming up. There is a traffic accident on 224 on the coming into town. The traffic is backed up already onto eastbound 80 leading onto 224. Then that's parallel with the firehouse on the frontage road. So be aware of that. And then traffic coming in the back way on 248 is parallel with Home Depot right now. So either way you're coming in, it's going to be a long wait. We've got more Sundance on the weekend, part of the Sundance Reel, coming up in just a moment.
Welcome back to Sundance Reel on the weekend. And we have with us the director of the documentary Studio 54, Matt Turnauer. How you doing, Matt?
Very good, thank you.
And David Darcy. Now, David is of a certain age, so I have to ask, you know, what are your memories when they decided to let you into Studio 54? What are your memories of that place?
I remember that a Heineken, which was considered the greatest beer in the world, was $6. And I thought that was just such an outrageous amount of money. But yeah, sure. I was rejected many more times than I was let in the early days. So as Matt goes into in his film. But tell me something. We talked to Nathaniel Kahn about bringing a film by contemporary art to Park City. I have not seen any disco dancing in this town, although I'm sure there might have been some. Why bring a film like this to Sundance?
I think Sundance brought us. you know, we submitted and were accepted, and they, came with glee. It's funny, the kind of documentaries you think of being Sundance documentaries aren't this pop culture usually. So I was thrilled to make the cut. I didn't make the movie as a romp about sex, drugs, and disco. I actually wanted to make a kind of counter-narrative I saw it as an opportunity to make a movie about a certain part of the end of the 20th century, which was the period between the pill and the sexual revolution and the advent of the HIV/AIDS crisis.
Right, right. Where does the footage come from? Was this one of the most videotaped places in its day?
Actually not. They were very protective. I think that's one of the secrets to their success, is that not only was the door guarded strictly, so not everyone could get in there, but they really handpicked the press and were extremely selective. They wanted to make their patrons, who were high profile, feel comfortable. So photographers were extremely limited and cameras were very controlled. For the film, one of our great finds was 3 hours of 16 millimeter that was shot there and had never been seen before. So most of the film you see in the archival passages of the film have never been seen by an audience.
So is this the I should know this. Is this the first feature doc on Studio 54?
Yeah, it is. There've been, I think, Behind the Music gave it some treatment in the 90s, but this is the first one.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You find the roots for this in gay culture. And talk about that. It's an interesting part of this that a lot of people might not know.
Very much so. Disco was a form of music that was a kind of cult music, and it was in normally African-American underground clubs. And when it crossed over, it first crossed over into gay clubs. The club scene in New York City from the late 60s through the 70s was incredibly vibrant, incredibly rich, and had many aspects to it. There was a certain time in the early 70s when gay music culture and black music culture began to blend. And this really is part of the origin story of Studio, because that underground music scene, which was populated by a really diverse mix of people, which was one of the glories of it, kind of exploded into the disco movement of the mid-70s. And Studio has its origins in that.
Okay, tell us about the two guys who founded Studio 54. It's interesting. am I exaggerating by calling them founders of...
Creators and founders, they're everything. The two driving partners, there was a silent partner named Jack Touche, who's still, he's in the movie, but he's unknown to history. Ian Schrager and Steve Rubell were the founders of Studio 54. One reason I was attracted to this story is it's also a story of the rise of the meritocracy in New York. The 70s was the lowest moment of the city. It was 76 was Ford to City Drop Dead, right. The famous tabloid cover that marked the brink of bankruptcy in the city. And Rubell and Schrager were these ambitious Brooklyn kids who had a disco in Queens, which was not on the map, and had this burning desire to conquer the nightclub world. And they were punching way above their weight and had big dreams and ambitions and scrounged the funding to open what they wanted to make the greatest disco of all time. I love this footnote in the film where the funding for the disco came from a client whose bar mitzvah they had executed at their Queens nightclub. So the origins of Studio are not only disco, but bar mitzvahs, which I think is really a footnote we unearthed. We could talk about Steve and Ian forever. They're endlessly compelling. And the film really is a love story between these two guys. They weren't a couple. One was gay, Steve Rubell, and Ian Schrager is straight, but they were, as Schrager says in the film, married.
Right. What do you say? So are you prepared that a lot of the audience, particularly here, maybe people who were born after Studio 54 closed?
Statistically, probably.
Yeah, so prepare them for something that they may not have any lived experience of.
Well, you know, the film tries to debunk a lot of myths about Studio. I think there are a lot of smoke screens about that place, The Door, which was very much a reality, but people tend to be obsessed with the doorman policy. The velvet rope was invented there. We go through that in the film. And sex, drugs, and disco, which were all there in copious amounts. But I think the sociological story and the kind of specialness of the place, which is tied into that. The city was at its lowest ebb at this time. And it was also the last gasp of the analog world, I think. And people wanted to go out and have a really good time. And what really just cannot be avoided is that sex could not kill you immediately, or so immediately then. So the sense of freedom and specialness and insiderness that could exist in this place, which then was created as a kind of adult Disneyland, the art direction of it and the drama of it and the effort that went into it was unprecedented. So all these things converged to create something that has become kind of improbably, I have to say, immortal. There's no reason that a nightclub and a theater should be remembered, talked about, and obsessed over worldwide 40 years later. But there was a frisson and a je ne sais quoi to this place that we try to get at in the film.
Well, because it's about much more about what was going on there than about this place being an architectural landmark.
Well, I think the architecture did have something to do with it. And Ian Schrager is the mastermind behind that, the genius of this. It was in a theater. It was in the theater where What's My Line was filmed or broadcast. And this is something that also intrigued me, because what a symbol of the old New York, where people, you know, that was a game show where the panelists dressed in black tie and spoke with Middle Atlantic accents and referred to Broadway as Broadway. And that was the New York that was going down the tubes, and Studio was the New York that replaced it. So I loved the symbolism of that. So the architecture did have something to do with it, and the drama of it, and they used the theater because they dropped things from the flies, and that had never been done before. And this made it a much more heightened experience. But it also, I think, at the end of the day, people make it. Yeah, and the people that gathered there were what made it immortal.
Yeah, and if I walk up Main Street tonight at the height of Sundance and pass some of the club entrances and the guys at the door, I mean, how much of that was shaped by Studio 54 culture?
Almost totally. Isn't it incredible? The Velvet Rope, the origin of the Velvet Rope is interesting. In the case of Studio, it was an accident. There were prostitutes on 8th Avenue, and they wanted to keep them out of the vestibule. So they had velvet ropes that were left over from when CBS used it as a TV studio, and they would marshal the studio audiences through these velvet ropes. Then, as the place became popular very quickly, they needed them. Before that, gay clubs used velvet ropes to keep women out and to keep straight guys out. And they had, for instance, at the gay clubs, no open toe shoe policies. That was a way to keep women out of the clubs. So the velvet rope was meant to kind of stop the line at the door and slow it down. But Studio transformed it, and it's a worldwide and very tiresome, might I add, custom that we all have to endure.
Let's broaden this for a second. You had a film in Toronto, and now this. How can you explain how one makes films so quickly?
In some respects, it's an illusion. We need Albert Einstein to explain this, because in the film you're referring to, Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood, which was made with private equity, and it took sufficiently long enough to make that it's kind of bumping into the films that I made subsequently. So it's a bit of a special effect. But you know, when you're making doc films, and especially indie docs, which I'm very proud to be making, the funding sometimes comes slowly. So you have to do a few things at once. And I like that, because it allows you to kind of hop from one project to another, and you have different pools of collaboration. This is the joy for me. David, you'll identify with this, coming from the world of writing, the loneliest job in the world. Filmmaking is the least lonely, probably, and that's part of why I love doing it so much.
Are any of the Studio 54 people from that era going to be at the screening?
Yes. The doorman, the mythic Mark Beneke, who really is. I mean, I'm not a disco nightclub person. I'm more of a kind of cultural diver. And I didn't know about Mark Beneke particularly. I knew there was a doorman. But if you talk to people of a certain vintage, they all know who Mark Beneke is, a certain type and certain vintage. He's here. And Myra Shear, who was his co-conspirator, who did the list Some of the DJs are here for it.
Now, does the name is the name still an owned brand? Does someone own the name Studio 54?
It's complicated. It's gotten kind of divided up. At a certain point, MGM bought the logo, and they have the logo. The name, I'm actually not so sure. We've called the movie Studio 54, so I'm not sure. No one's come to sue us yet, but I don't think the name is particularly owned.
Is the film for sale? Are you looking for a distributor here, or is there already a distributor?
It's a situation where A&E Indie Films has financed it, and we're here selling it for theatrical.
Mm. Any interest yet?
You know, I haven't. We just got here, and the sales agents are in some incredible villa up the mountain there, conspiring. I've been told there's a lot of interest, but we haven't kind of spread the tarot cards out yet.
Okay, can you take a few seconds and talk about the legal battle that you go into in the film, and the effort to prosecute them, and the massive effort to stay alive as long as they could.
Yeah, I mean, this is a rise and fall and rise again story. Studio 54 was invaded by the feds, and the owners were prosecuted for a massive skimming operation, and they went to prison. No one thought they would, but they did. And it's sort of like James Dean and Marilyn Monroe and JFK. Nothing that amazing lasts forever. It's kind of 33 months was the era that the film covers. And people are shocked that it was that brief a period.
Right. Well, thank you so much. And Rick can tell people when they can see this.
All your screenings are ahead of you. It looks like Sunday morning at the Mark, and Monday afternoon down at the Redstone One, showing in Salt Lake, but next Friday over at the Ray at again in the morning, 9:30 a.m. And I guess get out your disco shoes and bring the disco balls or something.
Yeah, the disco snow boots we look out the
disco,
window.
disco snow boots, yes. Matt Turnauer, thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
Studio 54.
Thank you both.
All right.
Hi, Dan Dearden here, owner of Just Right Air and new sponsor of KPCW Programming. Just Right Air has been advising Park City area homeowners to repair, replace, and maintain their heating and air conditioning since 2004. Details at justrightair.com.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, presenting Viridian, 21 new residences along the 11th fairway of the Canyons Golf Course with year-round amenities and gondola access. Summers on the fairway, winters on the slopes. More information at ViridianParkCity.com.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
All right, just a quick look at traffic again at 924, and you're listening to KPCW. According to UDOT, there's another crash reported on 248. Clearance time expected for that to be around 10:30. And there's a crash on US 40 in the Silver Summit area near Exit 2. Clearance time for that is around 10:15. There is quite a parking lot coming in both ways into town, both on 224 and 248. Buses in town, though, seem to be running all right. At around 9:50, we'll get a report from Carolyn Murray. Apologize for mispronouncing her name earlier. And she'll tell us what is going on with the rally, if there's any changes. If you are going to the rally, that is happening at the north end of City Park. You're listening to KPCW. We've got more of the Sundance Reel coming up. Thank you.
continuing this Sundance Reel for the weekend with co-host David Darcy and the director and producer of the film The Oslo Diaries. This is in the World Cinema documentary, and we're with more Lucy.
Yes.
And Daniel Sivan.
Yes, that's and, right. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for being here in this wintry part of the world. It was it was not snowing here until the filmmakers showed up. So, but the Oslo Diaries is about an episode in the conflict in the Middle East. Is this a well-known story, or is it actually something that you're talking about that is not very well-known history?
Well, you know, the Oslo Accords in Israel is a very well-known event. I mean, everyone knows, most of people knows the handshake between Rabin and Arafat shaking their hands in the White House with Bill Clinton in 1994. But I think not a lot of people actually knows the story behind the scenes. What really happened in that moment? What was really signed? What was the human connection? What happened behind the scenes that eventually, you know, peace had failed? What we had there, people is not well known about it, and we're so thrilled and happy to tell this story.
So this started in 1992, and what brought a group of Israelis and a group of Palestinians together?
You know, it was 1992. The PLO, which was the Palestinian Liberation Organization, was illegal. Yasser Arafat was the leader. Israel was not willing to talk to Yasser Arafat. Rabin was the Israeli leader. He went on election, and people vote for him because he promised peace, but nothing happened, you know. In 7 months, 8 months, 9 months went on, and nothing happened. And then two professors that no one knew anything about them said to themselves, okay, we have an opportunity to really speak to the PLO, which they are the only, you know, leader that the Palestinians are actually recognizing them. They had this opportunity, an illegal opportunity, and they went for it. These two anonymous professors went to meet the leaders of the PLO, and a secret talks went on behind the scenes. And we are telling this whole story through their personal diaries of the negotiators, of these professors, everything that went on in the secret talks and this secret meetings that went on. We're revealing everything for the first time.
Yeah, it's really quite an eye-opener to get the testimony from people not only who were negotiating, but people who, through the course of it, saw the hope here and the end. Well, I hope it's not the end of hope, but the failure of the Oslo Accords.
Does that mean the high school?
And the rise, which seems to be a parallel development with the rise of Benjamin Netanyahu. Talk about the parallel between the effort to make peace and the effort by Netanyahu to leverage opposition to the peace for the benefit of his own political career, in the course of which you get the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin by an Israeli.
Well, I think really, I mean, it's kind of the chicken and an egg. It's kind of difficult to say what came first, the rise of Netanyahu or the death of the peace process. But really, I mean, for us, the story is a story about a public of people that are too afraid to make peace. They are hanging with all they can to the old Middle East, as you can put it. They don't want to take that leap of faith and say, okay, let's try and make something new. And on the Israeli side, you had the Greater Israel camp saying, we better have the whole of the Holy Israel and not give one piece of land back to the Palestinians. It's better than to have peace. And on the Palestinian side, you had the radicals saying, we believe in the greater Palestine. We want to be back in our homeland, and we will not compromise. And these two radical sides basically took over the process.
How did you get everybody to talk to you?
Well, would you like to answer?
You know, it was not easy. Of course, I think in every documentary, the research is like the stone corner of what you do. And I think that from the moment we understood that we want to make a film about why peace has failed, we looked for the right angle. And when we started speaking to Ron Pundak, which he's now unfortunately not with us anymore, but we started speaking with Yair Hirschfeld and all the main characters, we understood that this is where all happened, Oslo. And then we started speaking to them, and they gave us their diaries. Really, we are very fortunate to get hold of, and also it's from both sides, yeah, also the Palestinian side. All of the Palestinian leadership was interviewed to this film, so it's very, you know, we had to snuggle into the Palestinian territory, you know, in order to interview them. We were their guests, you know. For us as Israelis, it's illegal to even go there. So it was like to really talk to the other side, really listen to them.
Yeah, and there were some real friendships that developed in the course of this. But now, there's been talk of Norway recently in the United States. Donald Trump thinks more people from Norway should be coming here, I guess because they work hard. We don't really know. But these are the Oslo Accords. What was the role of Norway in bringing Israelis and Palestinians together in an estate in the middle of the woods and the snow in Norway, secretly, that the Israeli embassy in Norway was saying it knew nothing about and may not have known anything about? Talk about that.
So I think Norway was really a key player here in the sense that they were really the neutral mediators. I mean, the U.S., as you see now with Trump, is very, very, very one-sided towards Israel. And for the Palestinians, it's very hard to trust the U.S. The Norwegians were really a neutral side in this whole manner. And the fact that they brought these people for secret talks away from the chaos of the Middle East, on the one hand, it gave them some kind of solitude to look at their life in a more reflective manner. You know, walking in the snow, it's something we don't get in the Middle East. And on the other hand, it gave them a lot of privacy. And that privacy is what basically kept them alive, because if the talks would have leaked out, the Palestinians' lives would have been in danger and all of the Israelis would be in jail for a very long time. So that was a very important role of Norway.
Okay, so as in the case of so many films here, a lot of the audience will barely have been teenagers by the time of the Oslo Accords. And a lot of people watching this may have a kind of despondent feeling about the future in the Middle East, not just between Israel and Palestine, but Syria, Iraq, everywhere. What do you want the younger audience to take from this film? I mean, in a way, you're sort of Middle East 101 for a lot of people for whom this is, you know, decades in the past.
Yeah, for us it's more than that. For us it's really, I mean, when you look back at the Palestinian Liberation Organization, they were a group of the most hideous terrorists in the eyes of the Israelis. And the Israelis were really a group of conquerors in the eyes of the Palestinians. And it's really not very far from having now Donald Trump having real peace talks with ISIS or Netanyahu having real peace talks with the Hamas. I mean, these are two sworn enemies that really decided to sit and talk their way out of it. For us, that's the most inspiring part about it, really doing that leap of faith.
Well, let's look at this as cinema. You know, you think, oh, God, they're making a film about people sitting around a table in some house in Norway with a gray sky. But every time you cut away to anyone's reaction, there's a riot. Or, you know, you get mass unrest or whatever. So you went from, you know, theater in an enclosed space to, you know, to public spaces with people saying all sorts of outrageous things.
I think that was the challenge, you know, to go between those negotiations and that you really feel how risky is these negotiations, you know, how dangerous they are, because outside there is chaos, there is chaotic, people are dying, there's no time. And inside the room, it's from, on the one hand, it's you know, disconnected, but on the other hand, this is the real thing. So for us, the connection between the inside and the outside was so important, and unfortunately the outside has won.
But this is the truth of diplomacy. These, over the course of these negotiations, these men, they were all men, learn about each other as real people. And then the challenge is to sell this or persuade a public that this is the direction to take. And this is the, you know, the challenge of diplomacy in every context. Well, and it's I don't want to give it away, but we know the history of this, so the audience will see this.
Yes,
no,
and
no spoiler alerts.
Maybe they have achieved peace. You will never know.
Just as long as you're not a Muslim from certain countries that can't come to the United States, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Tune in to the next episode of the Oslo Diaries. The film here at Park City has a showing tomorrow, 6 p.m. at the Ray?
No, it's the Yarrow.
It's the Yarrow. It's six tomorrow. Come,
yes, yeah.
Join us. Also, be enraged.
All right. Also Monday at the Redstone One, and Thursday at Park City Library, and final showing Saturday at the Holiday Village. Again, Moore Lushi and Daniel Sivan with the Oslo Diaries. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
This is Travis Vernon, fly fishing coordinator of JANS and longtime supporter of KPCW. Our fly fishing department and guide service is open year-round and offers a full line of flies and product, including brands like Sims, Sage, and Fishpond. We also rent rods, reels, and waders. Available at the flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or JANS.com.
This is Mark with ESCO Heating, Air, Plumbing, and Electrical, and we support local radio KPCW. Most house fires start due to bad wiring and old electrical panels. We recommend an annual electrical inspection. ESCOUtah.com, 855-ESCO-NOW. That's ESCO, ESCO.
This is John Gay with Deer Valley Ski School, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our gold standard of instruction offers an array of services for all ability levels, including private and group instruction, locals programs, and adaptive ski lessons. For information and reservations, 645-6648 or DeerValley.com.
And finally, we're back with the Sundance Reel. And finally, to wrap up the Saturday show, well, you know, you've heard of the McLaughlin Group, but you know, also famous at Sundance is the Darcy Bunch, which is our film industry pros who gather with David and come in every year to see us. And going from west to east, we've got Ann Thompson with IndieWire.
I am. Happy to be here. Okay. It's a ritual I love.
Yeah, all right. We love ritual. And John Sloss from Cinetech.
Synetic. I'm east of Bob Burney. Well, I guess west east in the studio. Got
and
it.
To the far east is Bob Burney from, is it Amazon Studios?
Amazon Studios.
And
thanks for having me back.
David. Okay. Well, it's always great to have you guys in here. And, I even saw that there was a blog headline a couple months ago that said, Ann Thompson boldly makes her predictions for the Golden Globes. Did you know
terribly, but I always do terribly with the Globes. They're not predictable. Oscars are better.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's address this. Is independent film now the tail on the much bigger dog of television?
Well, I think television and independent film are both, they're both sort of blending together. The directors go from TV to film and back and forth, the actors. So there's no, and it's, I think the success of independent film is also, and television is driving each other. Like the more the better. I think the fourth quarter of this year with all the great films, I think films are out there doing good. It makes people go to other movies and watch television.
What do you think, John?
Yeah. I think Bob's exactly right. It's very fluid. The idea of a 12-hour narrative, is appealing to people, it's appealing to storytellers, it's appealing to actors, and it's appealing to the audience. But if you look at the fourth quarter and you look at what was working in the cinemas, that's very much alive.
And I think Sundance, again, is indicative of what an important role the independents play as a sort of farm team for the entire industry. People are here, the HBO guy, Len LaMotto, all these people, they're all looking for talent. And that's what it's about.
I mean, it is true. If you look at whether it's Rian Johnson or Justin Lin or even Jake Kasdan, you look at the people who are making the billion-dollar grossing films.
Rian Johnson was here with Brick not so long ago.
Which I happen to sell.
Can you tell us how much you sold it for back in the day?
$1 billion.
$1 billion
is not what it used to be. Yeah.
We have, indie director I've worked with a lot, Nicholas Vending Refn, and he's making for our series side at Amazon a huge series now.
Mm-hmm. But is it, to overstate it, it used to be that independent film was kind of a content driver that television might pick up on later on. Is that, that's not the case anymore? It's much more symbiotic, I would think.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think, in fact, television is probably driving it a bit even more. It's definitely equal on parity.
Okay. What are the tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts, going to do for independent film or for cinema at all? Is that going to make that much of a difference?
Well, it certainly could accelerate Apple's move into the space. They seem to be repatriating billions and billions of dollars, which, I don't know.
What's the timing on that, John?
I don't know, and I try not to give too much promotion to the GOP and the president, but it seems like, if the stock market's any indication, it's already being taken on board. I mean, the timing's now.
If the reports about Amazon are any indication, they don't seem to be hurting too much.
Yeah, I think, we have, the series side has huge bets, Lord of the Rings, we're making lots of movies.
Bob, are you going to spill the beans here on which city is going to get the second Amazon headquarters?
No, and we're the last to know, but it's like huge number of jobs and stuff.
We have a technical park 6 miles out of Park City by the highway. Just saying.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, I'll note that.
I heard that Amazon. I was talking to someone on the bus, which I've been taking. I've heard that Amazon has a warehouse in Utah that the building itself is 26 acres, so you're already a presence here. And we rely on you for predictions. What city is Amazon going to choose? Just say anything.
No clue.
Well, I had a question for Bob and John, because you're the folks that are here. You're looking for product.
I'm looking to sell product.
And we're buying.
You're buying. Well, maybe the question that is directly for Bob, but
We gave a version of this question to John Cooper, but what would happen if there's a great premiere at the Eccles tonight, and you huddle with the filmmaker, and he's willing to make a good deal, and it's a pretty significant amount of money. Maybe it's sets a record for Sundance, and you purchase the rights on this film. Three days later, three women come forward and say that the director assaulted them in a hot tub at different dates in the past. Maybe at Sundance, who knows? But what
was the film where this happened? Wasn't it 2 years ago? Well, the film.
Birth of a Nation.
Birth of a Nation. This happened. What was
it's
the
a
event?
It's a cloud over the industry. This kind of thing, sure. Yeah.
Absolutely, because in that particular case, it really hurt the movie. And I think it's no one knows what's going on now, because it's not about just films that are premiering. It's films that are going to be made, and everybody wants to know everything about everybody that's in the movie in any way, and no one can know. But it's a cloud hanging over production, acquisitions, everything.
Well, John, you draw up contracts. I mean, your firm does this kind of work. Is there
women?
Is there a morals clause? Is there something that you have you revised contracts to account for this?
Well, I wouldn't be the one promoting morals contracts or clauses, but yes, they are clearly going to be part of the conversation. And interestingly enough, I also think it's going to accelerate the release of films acquired at Sundance, because every day leaves open the possibility of some new disclosure.
That's true. To your question, like, will we buy the film Saturday and release it next week?
Exactly. Let's step back to last year's. Is there, for the three of you, is there a film that had extremely, what performed best among Sundance films last year, in the past year, and what film was the classic, you know, Sundance explosion of interest and underperformance in the broader market?
So you've got Bob's The Big Sick, which he can claim credit for, and then you've got Patty Cakes from Fox Searchlight, which sold for $9.5 million and made less than just about $1 million.
I like that film.
It was an excellent film, but it didn't appear to be a theatrical film. Bob, you could address that.
Like The Big Sick was a big sale here last year and ended up performing really well, I think, and also the typical kind of comedy film like that is not expected usually to get in the awards circuit, but Big Sick has been right up there. So that's been one of the best performing ones. And Patty Cakes, for whatever reason, did not connect with the audience. And that's sort of both sides of the equation. You can bet big and it can go either way.
So companies like Searchlight, you're still in the game, but a lot of companies like Searchlight and Focus are sort of saying, we're putting our money in production. We're going to control what we're making, and we're not going to buy as many movies. We're not going to get caught in this kind of bidding war.
Which is a weird paradox, because obviously production has more unknown inherent in it than seeing a finished film and buying it. But Searchlight is right in the thick of it with the awards this year, and those are from productions.
That's so, right.
What about Searchlight? What's the future of Searchlight? We're doing predictions here.
Word on the street is that they're going to survive because they are distinct and unique and provide a service that no one else at Disney does. And that things are looking good. We don't know, but things are looking good.
And as Disney develops its over-the-top service, they're really going to need content. So I think they're going to go for a full range, which would include Searchlight-type movies.
And I think especially the timing, having Guillermo's movie and Three Billboards when you're being acquired, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of Oscar-nominated films, and we need some predictions, please.
Speaking of Shape of Water, that's my pick for Best Picture. We will find out on the. It will be the movie that gets the most nominations. That's going to lend it some momentum because it has everything. It appeals to men. It appeals to women. It has all the crafts behind it. The Directors Guild behind it. PGA. Everything. So Three Billboards, which has been sort of winning things, I have a strong sense that that's a more divisive movie.
Okay, is that what you predict would win or what you want to? What's in
predict
your heart?
Would win. Yeah. And The Shape of Water was also my favorite movie of the year.
Well, certainly, I think for sure he'll get director.
Yes.
Guillermo.
Yes, he will.
Because everybody in Hollywood and the world would like to see that.
Yeah, he's immensely popular.
He is. He really is.
Any other best actress?
Frances McDormand, I would say. Again, she's going against Sally Hawkins for Shape of Water, but I think Frances will continue to win. And the supporting actress race will be between Allison Janney and the Lady Bird actress, who I think could actually
Laurie Metcalf.
Laurie Metcalf.
Oh, so you don't see Saoirse Ronan winning best actress?
I don't think so. I think Laurie. I think Greta Gerwig will win screenplay.
That. I think, yeah, I agree. I think Fran McDormand, you know, if you think of her throwing Molotov cocktails in the movie, that sort of attitude and for women in general, that let's get behind that.
Okay, yeah. And best actor?
Oh, that'll be Gary Oldman, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll get back to that in just a second. We have Carolyn Murray live from City Park at the upcoming Respect Rally. So, Carolyn, come in. How do things look down there besides snow?
Hey there. How are you doing, Rick?
We're warm and dry, doing fine.
Well, lucky you. It's a little chilly. We've got crowds are gathering. I'd say we've got a couple hundred people here so far. My understanding is that the roads, well, I actually don't have a report on the roads at this point. There were accidents on 224 that the last I heard had not been cleared, but don't take that as gospel at this point. I'm working my way back over to talk with some of the city representatives to see what their update is.
Okay, any sense of what the mood of the crowd is right now?
Well, the mood is really positive. There are a plethora of signs, and people are actually from all over the country, and we've had representatives from Oakland and San Diego and Seattle, locals, Park City people. And it looks like I've got a chance here to get maybe an update on how the roads are doing. I've got Lynn Ware Peak from the city. Do we have an update, Lynn, on how 224 and 248 are, and would you like to be live and talk about it? Okay. You good with that, Rick? We've got Lynn coming on now.
Go for it.
Hey, Rick. Good morning. Well, amazingly, within town, apparently traffic is flowing okay. Park City Mountain Resort, no surprise, that parking lot is full. So anyone coming into town to do anything, whether it's coming to the Respect Rally or to ski, needs to go to the high school. There's still parking availability there, and take a shuttle from there. And in terms of getting into town, if you're coming up on I-80, apparently it's backed up to the Jeremy Ranch exit coming in. And then going out of town, outbound, there is a light out at the canyons, but that's going out of town, so that's not a huge deal. However, it is backing up traffic to about Temple Har Shalom. And that's about all I have at the moment. Back to Carolyn. And so, Rick.
Okay.
Are we all?
Okay. Well, we're on the air here, but after post 10 o'clock, we will check in with you for further updates.
Thank you.
We'll be
in touch.
Yep. Bye. Bye
now.
Okay.
Any thoughts about new genres, new kinds of films emerging this year at Sundance? Is it too soon to generalize? If it is, just generalize anyway.
Well, there are some documentary filmmakers making features, and so you have Crystal Moselle, who is here with Wolfpack, with this Skate Kitchen, where it's sort of like a kids-like movie, where she observes these tough girl skaters in New York. And then you have Bart Layton making a transition from The Imposter to American Animals, which played very well yesterday at the Eccles. Clever mixing of documentary and feature.
I think that's kind of a trend. If you look at American Animals, which is a brilliant combination. In fact, the actual characters were almost as, I don't want to say more, but
no, they make it work, I think.
And then if you look, compare that to, you know, Errol Morris's Wormwood. And
very close.
It's a trend.
Isn't that what Clint Eastwood's doing with his new film?
Yeah, exactly.
He's using the actual people from the assault on the train as the stars of his movie.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed when the director of American Animals said he wouldn't bring the real people out on stage, because by the end of the film, those were the people I really wanted to hear from. And that one guy is great. The one guy who was at the, who was the animator of the ring of would-be art thieves or book thieves from a university, is now studying filmmaking. So God,
there it is.
It's a natural evolution.
Full circle. Yeah.
And again, and these kids went to prison. So.
He had a flair for the dramatic.
Yeah, he did. He certainly thought he did. I don't want to give. So go see it and make your own decisions, folks. Any thoughts about awards here at the festival? Any things that really, and any things that you've really, really liked?
I just want to give a plug, as I want to do, for documentaries. There are tremendously commercial documentaries at the festival this year. It's unclear where they will factor in the awards conversation at the end of the year, but in terms of just pure commercial populism, there's great.
The one I keep hearing about, which I have to try to see today, is Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is one of the better filmmakers, Morgan Neville, and he's addressing, of course, Mr. Rogers. And apparently this has a very deep emotional impact on people. People cry.
I think Sundance is known for documentaries, and the audience response is great here. The opening was Generation Wealth, Lauren Greenfield, who's been back. She had Queen of Versailles, and I think people look forward to docs here, the audience.
Yeah, if I could make, well, I'm not going to plug it. I saw before the festival Three Identical Strangers, which is an irresistible crowd pleaser about triplets separated at birth. And I don't want to give too much away, but this is something that the audience won't be able to take itself away from. It plays extremely well. The characters are fantastic, and the story behind it is a really unnerving testimony about scientific research. And you wonder what the scientific research in our era is going to make for a film 20 years from now.
And maybe if we have a little time, can anybody tell me, you know, we're talking about the value of art objects with some other films in the festival, but does anybody know if you got a bootleg copy of All the Money in the World with Kevin Spacey, how valuable would that be?
They say there may be some version of this movie shown on DVD at some point.
So it's more valuable than the latest snuff film, unless the person in the snuff film is Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, snuffing someone's career. Yeah.
By the way, I saw All the Money in the World.
With the Spacey.
No, I saw Spacey. The one with Christopher Plummer.
The Plummer.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it was really not all that it could have been.
Okay.
Does anybody, well, I know Bob, the very discreet Bob Burney, is nodding approvingly.
Yeah, okay. I mean, hey. Look. It is what it is, yeah. And I thought there, I also thought it was weird to attract the audience with just the ear on the billboard, like a cut-off bloody ear. That made me want to go.
It works for Vincent Van Gogh.
Sorry.
By the way, the other character in this saga at Sundance, back to the festival, is Netflix. And one of the favorite movies I saw was called Private Life from Tamara Jenkins, which was on opening night. And you'll see that in Netflix eventually.
Okay. Thanks, everybody, for gathering here for the Sundance Reel. I want to thank David Darcy and the panel, who were not Three Identical Strangers, who are Ann Thompson of IndieWire, Bob Burney of Amazon Studios, John Sloss of Cinetic, and this is KBCW Park City. This program is presented by Sandra Lee Incorporated with the documentary Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee. Thanks very much. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thank you. A pleasure, as always.
Some of the world's up-and-coming filmmakers will be in Park City for the 2018 Sundance Film Festival, and you can find out all about their newest project. Tune into KPCW each weekday morning between 9 and 10 for the Sundance Reel, and for the first weekend of the festival between 8 and 10 to hear from filmmakers, producers, and film critics. That's the Sundance Reel through January 26th right here on KPCW or online at kpcw.org.
Support for the Sundance Reel comes from the documentary Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, with public screenings during the 2018 Sundance Film Festival.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.